Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me very great pleasure today to welcome Dr. Ginaldo Jaime, who is Vice President of Angola. After suffering a 27-year civil war, Africa's longest civil war, Angola finally realized a lasting peace in 2002. Today, as the country moves from a situation of war to one of peace, from an avowedly socialist economic model to a market-oriented one, Angola is grappling with this transition, with the impact and legacy of the war and its devastating social, economic, and political consequences. Millions were killed or displaced by fighting. A once thriving agricultural sector completely collapsed. Infrastructure was destroyed. Landmines littered the countryside. And democratic elections have not been held since 1992. Nonetheless, the country is on the road to recovery. And I'm honored this evening to introduce our speaker, who is playing a very important role in that recovery. Dr. Aguinaldo Jaime has previously served the government of Angola as Minister of Finance and Governor of the National Bank. And he is currently serving as a Deputy Prime Minister, heading Angola's economic team, which is responsible for overseeing the implementation of these economic reforms. He's played an instrumental role in restoring fiscal balance and reducing inflation, which fell from 325% in 2000 to 18% in 2005. He also has the pleasure of managing sticky negotiations with the IMF, and I'm sure he'll talk to us about that as well. Today he'll be reflecting mainly on recent developments in Angola and explaining the government's plans for Angola's future economic development. Please give a warm welcome to Dr. Aguinaldo Jaime.
Professor Joe Bill, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests. I would like, first of all, to thank the board and management of the London School of Economics for the invitation extended to me to address this audience today. The LSE is one of the most prestigious teaching institutions in the UK, and whose prestige has reached other parts of the world, including Angola, my country. And that's the reason why I have accepted this kind invitation to be here today. I shall try to seize this opportunity to unveil the current economic and financial situation in Angola. As you all know, Angola achieved its independence in 1975, November. And at the time, the Angolan government opted for the socialist model inspired by the Soviet Union experience. The reasons for that are twofold. First of all, the political alliance within the Soviet bloc during the liberation war against Portugal, and second, the sincere belief that socialism was the model capable of bringing about economic development combined with social justice. Some features of the Angolan economy at the time. So the state-owned companies were regarded as the main engine for economic growth and social justice. The role of the state was set out in the national planning, which also encompassed the main goals of the economic policy. And the state controlled all the prices of goods and services, and there was a limited role for the private sector and market mechanisms. Some words about the financial sector at the time. The central bank used to perform regulatory and supervisory roles on the one hand, and commercial roles on the other hand. Interest rates and exchange rates were fixed by the central bank. No private investment, and especially no foreign investment, was allowed in the financial sector. And there was little diversification of the financial system. We only had, at the time, banks and one insurance company, all of them owned by the state. There were credit ceilings and programs of directional credits, which means that the government used to design special programs, and the banks were forced to put money in those programs with a strong emphasis on social goals. The results of this administrative managed economy in the economic field, I would say there was waste and inefficiency in the administrative and in the economic sector, state-owned. Prices did not reflect the cost of goods and services and could not, therefore, signal the most profitable activities. This led to big losses and huge deficits, financed by credit of the central bank, which, on the other hand, fueled inflationary tensions in the economy. No foreign investment except in the mineral economy, oil basically, and offshore. And this scenario was further aggravated by the direct and indirect effects of the civil war, which in the meantime broke out in the country, opposing the free liberation movements. And finally, flourishing parallel market, you know, emerged, both in the real economy, both in the financial sector. So a few words about what happened in the financial sector as a result of this economic model we opted for when we achieved our independence in 1975. There was inefficiency caused by state intervention and the volatility of the national currency. The financial system was incapable of attracting domestic savings, and that there was an accumulation of non-performing loans in the banking system. A highly speculative economy developed. Let me just say that the spread of the exchange rates between the official market and the parallel market sometimes would exceed 100%. The results were really disappointing. The social justice we thought we could bring about when we adopted the socialist type of management of the economy made the government to carefully think about our own future. We were then in the 80s, more precisely in 1987. At the time, I remember there was a major crisis in the oil, the prices of the oil sector, which were very low, around $10 a barrel. And obviously, as a combination of that, internal factors, the disappointment with the results achieved by our economic policies, and also a wave of democratization in Soviet Union. I remember that at the time Gorbachev launched Perestroika and Glasnost, so prompted us to rethink our model and to adopt a new one based on a free market economy. So then a transitional period started where we tried to stabilize the economy, to fight inflation, control the budget deficit. How? By reducing public expenditure to a sustainable level, to broaden the tax base, to simplify the tax structure, and improve tax and customs administration. And also increase public savings through the rationalization of expenditure. And we also found non-inflationary ways to finance the state deficit instead of being financed, as in the past, by credit from the central bank. We also removed or reduced subsidies, liberalizing prices of goods and services. We privatized many of state-owned enterprises, especially the medium and the medium enterprises and small enterprises. And we also started some institutional reforms, setting up the institutional bodies to conceive and to implement and monitor the economic reform process, and to create the laws and regulations of a free market economy. We also created some social safety nets to cater for the negative impact of the reforms on the poor segments of our population. We also started a major process of rehabilitation of basic economic and social infrastructure. And finally, we liberalize the financial system. The exchange rate and the interest rates were not determined by the central bank as before, but subject to market fluctuations. We abolished the credit ceilings, but we did not, for reasons that I will explain later, liberalize our capital account. So the results of this new model and the transition to a free market economy were, as Professor Joel Bill stated here, very encouraging indeed. We managed to bring inflation under control. So just to give you some figures, in 2001 we had a three-digit inflation, 116. In 2002, still three-digit, 105. 2003, 76% of inflation. So for the first time in our economic history, we managed to bring down inflation from three-digit to double-digit. In 2004, it further reduced to 31%, 2005 to 18%, and in 2006, we think we will be around 10%. At least it is what it's stated as an economic goal in our current national budget. So far, judging by the results achieved up to March 2006, so we have a 2% inflation, 2% 35. So we believe if we continue in this path, we will manage really to bring inflation further down. The budgetary deficit was reduced to a sustainable level. Our currency stabilized in the exchange rate market, and our financial system diversified. BNA concentrated on its role as a regulatory and supervisory entity only, and the commercial functions were, you know, transferred to our commercial banks. In addition to the two state-owned banks that we had before, set new private-owned banks, you know, started operating in the market. We also created, at least we set, the basic regulation for our stock exchange, and new law was passed on non-banking financial institutions, such as investment funds, risk capital companies, leasing companies, discount houses, and so on. So, turning now into the correlation between financial system and economic development, I would like to leave a few thoughts with you, and we could further explore those ideas when you ask, you know, when it comes to the question time. I use economic development, meaning borrowing the concept that IMF has put forward some years ago, when Michel Candicius was the managing director of this institution, when he came with the concept of high quality growth. And by high quality growth, he meant economic growth with lasting employment gains, with poverty reduction, and which provides greater quality income through greater quality of opportunity, including for women, and also economic growth, which protects the environment. So this is basically the concept of economic development I will use. And the financial system, although I have mentioned that today the financial system in Angola is diversified, we have the banking sector, the non-banking sector, and also the stock exchange, but I will concentrate on the banking system because stock exchange has been recently set up, so we don't have really much experience on the functioning of a stock exchange. And although the new law on the non-banking financial institutions has already been passed, but there is a slow process of the creation of those type of institutions. So probably it's too soon to take stock of that experience. So I would say that judging from our experience in Angola, the financial sector played a decisive factor in bringing about economic development, in bringing about the development of the real economy, especially in its initial stage of development. So I would say that this seems to confirm that in this correlation there is a supply leading theory whereby in the course of this process the real economy will strengthen and will later, not in the beginning but later on, become the decisive factor in the correlation between financial system and economic growth. This is what happened in other developing countries. I was told that in some developed economies, you know, the reverse has happened. But in Angola, I would say that's really the financial sector who played a decisive role in bringing about, in promoting economic development. To finalize and to give you some time to ask me a few questions, so I would ask, what lessons can be drawn from the Angolan experience? Lesson number one. We have to take into consideration not only the government failures, but also market failures. So that's why we have to create, on the government side, checks and balances, accountability, public scrutiny of government decisions and processes to ensure that government always acts in pursuit of common good and prevent situations of conflict of interest relating to public servants. So this is obviously an ongoing process. Government and national planning, we came to conclude ourselves, cannot replace the market as engine to generate economic growth. But we also came to the conclusion that in addition to government failures, there are also market failures. I am talking about monopolistic and oligopolistic situations, and I put to you that market does not distribute fairly the wealth it generates, and obviously that needs some efficient government institutions to tackle market failures, to conceive strategies for development which should be inclusive, and to oversee its implementation. Also, the Angolan experience, you know, seems to confirm that market mechanisms alone sometimes are not enough to provide financing for all sectors of the economy, especially the least bankable ones, for example, agriculture. We have a large rural community, and in order to achieve food security and to give employment to our population, we had to solve the fact that in the banking sector, only 1% of the total credit was channeled to agriculture. So what was the solution that we found for that? We decided to create a special financial institution to finance development, especially to finance agriculture. Some, especially the World Bank and IMF, were not quite happy about that. They thought we should leave the market alone to play its role and not to intervene, because cheap money, as they put it, sometimes can create some other distortions. But the matter of fact is that we had to create this institution because otherwise we could not finance the non-mineral economy, and the non-mineral economy is the one that can provide jobs, can give employment, and can give revenues to our population as a way to fight poverty. Another lesson of the Angolan experience seems to be that economists normally say that there is a trade-off between stabilization and economic growth. You can't have both. You have to choose between one or the other. But we came to the conclusion in our model that if you invest in basic social and economic infrastructure and in human capital, you can have economic growth combined with stabilization. We were criticized by the fact that public expenditure represented around 50% of the GDP, which was said to be too high compared with other countries in the region. But our point was the other countries in the region did not add their infrastructure destroyed as it was the case in Angola. And that's why public expenditure had to play a decisive role in creating the environment so that we could have private and viable projects. Another lesson that we came to know from our experiences is that the opening up of the economy needs some time, a transitional period of protection for infant sectors of the economy until they achieve the strength to face external competition. In our view, this stance is fully compatible with the WTO rules for the least developed countries, category in which Angola falls. Ladies and gentlemen, these are some of the thoughts. I could go further, but I'd rather take some comments and questions from the floor. And these are some of the thoughts that I would like to share here with you. Obviously, much more remains to be said and to be done in Angola. Beyond the image of a country devastated by civil war, and despite facing the political and economic change challenges relating to a post-conflict situation, Angola is an interesting case study to be further explored by academicians and practitioners alike. My appeal to you, students and professors of the London School of Economics, is the following. Let us use the LCE knowledge and expertise to contribute meaningfully to the solutions of the challenges that Angola faces in the trilogy, stabilization, reconstruction, and economic development. I thank you for your kind attention.
Very much indeed for a very illuminating talk, and I think particularly interesting as we so often associate the Angolan economy and Angolan economic recovery associated with resources. And it was very interesting to hear you talk and put emphasis on other than mineral resources. However, I'd like to just start off and take my chair's privilege before opening it up to the floor to ask about the role of minerals in the economic recovery, and whether you feel this has been significant, and how you feel about the argument that sometimes such rich natural resources, particularly mineral resources, can be a curse rather than a blessing. Okay, we'll take a few questions and then have an answer and then another round. So if I can... Can you just wait, if you would just wait for the steward, yeah, thanks.
To continue with the theme of the so-called resource curse, one sort of mechanism why this is sort of postulated to occur is the sort of so-called Dutch disease, where the inrush of sort of foreign funds leads to such a appreciation of the exchange rate that it damages the rest of the economy. Has Angola experienced much problems with this, and especially with oil prices at such high levels and presumably investment sort of rushing in, particularly with America's concentration on and China's concentration on gaining resources around the world at the moment. Do you think that the Dutch disease could harm Angola's sort of economic recovery in the future?
Again, I'll take one more. Dr. Putzel.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Deputy Prime Minister. Could you tell us a little bit about your construction of the fiscal system, the taxation system, and what the strategy of the government is in relationship to this, particularly in the context of, I think you could take off from the discussion of the mineral-rich Angola, and give us, if you could, a little account of what's been happening with the public finances and what your strategy is over time in that regard. Thanks.
I think we'll stop at that. That's three quite demanding questions, and then take another round.
Well, thank you very much for the interesting questions you have asked. The first two are interrelated. The role of the mineral economy in the process of economic stabilization, and is there any danger of the Dutch disease with the appreciation of the exchange rate that could harm the competitiveness of the Angolan economy? So it's a statement of fact to say that the mineral economy has played a significant role not only in our exports but also in our GDP. Oil and diamonds accounts for almost 90% of our exports and around 60% of our GDP, which is really a very strong significance in the economy. So the strategy of the government is, as I said, to diversify the economy, to develop the non-mineral economy as a way to create employment opportunities for all and income for the Angolan population. Let me tell you that when we had the macroeconomic imbalances I just described with state deficits, huge inflation, imbalance in our current account and in our balance of payments accounts, where it was really difficult to attract foreign investment into the non-mineral economy. Foreign investors used to channel their resources in the offshore economy, as we call the mineral economy, because this economy uses US dollars. So it's a US dollar-based economy and does not use the national currency. So the volatility of the kwanza and all the macroeconomic imbalances that we had in the Angolan economy did not impact negatively in the oil and the mineral economy. So the strategy of the government, as long as we manage to stabilize the economy, creating greater confidence in the investors so that they would feel encouraged to put their money in the non-mineral economy, was, first of all, to create an enabling environment so that the non-mineral economy could flourish. So this is the reason why the state negotiated a few credit lines with some countries, and I could name a few of them. China, Germany, Brazil, Portugal, Israel, and some others. And those credit lines were used to finance capital expenditure only, not to finance any sort of current expenditure. So there was a rule which is stated now in our budget that foreign foreign credit loans shall be used only to finance capital expenditure. And by doing that, the government was rebuilding the basic infrastructure which was devastated by the Civil War. So this is one thing. Another thing is that, as I mentioned in my presentation, we decided to set up a financial institution with a goal, which goal is to finance the non-mineral economy, especially agriculture. Because, as I said, the financial sector was not able or interested, maybe because of the rate of return, maybe because of the risks involved, maybe because of the lack of adequate infrastructure. You know, financial sector was not financing the non-mineral economy, especially agriculture. So we use parts of our resources accrued from the oil sector. 5% every year is to fund this new Angolan Development Bank, whose mission, as I said, is to finance the non-mineral economy, especially agriculture. So our role is to use the oil revenues and the diamonds revenue to finance the non-mineral economy. At the same time, by stabilizing the economy, by creating an environment which is friendly to good business, we aimed to develop the non-mineral economy, such as agriculture, poultry, construction, fisheries, and so on. So we think that in the near future, Angola will not be dependent heavily on the oil economy as it is the case today. Obviously, there is the appreciation of our exchange rate. That's something that has occurred as a consequence of the increase in oil prices. So what are we going to do about that? In the short term, I don't think this is a major problem, because the Angolan economy has been devastated and is just recovering from the times of the Civil War. So while we lay down the basis, the foundation for development of the non-mineral economy, this real exchange rate effect will not impact negatively in the economy which is just developing. It can be a problem in the medium run. How will the government tackle that? We don't rule out the possibilities of introducing some tariff barriers. As I said, Angola is the least developed country according to the rules of the World Trade Organization, and if necessary, we will introduce this protection as a temporary way to gain competitiveness in our economy, to prepare those sectors, you know, to face external competition. On the other hand, there is a program in the oil sector that we call the Angolan Content. What is the Angolan Content? The Angolan Content is a program set up by the government with a view to increase the participation of Angolan citizens in the oil sector, especially in terms of training and managerial capabilities. And this program is going on very well. I was surprised when I attended just recently a workshop, when I could see the technical work that has been done by all the oil companies in terms of training. Most of the Angolans under this program came to attend, you know, the best universities all over the world, in Europe and the United States, preparing them to take over their responsibilities in the oil sector. So this is one of the aspects of this Angolan Content. The other one is to integrate more and more the oil sector into the overall economy. How? Entering into a partnership with oil companies, under this partnership, oil companies will finance some programs so that they will resort more and more to the Angolan market for the acquisition of goods and services rather than
resorting to external markets. So we believe with a combination of this strategy, the Angolan content on the other hand, and creating the conditions for the diversification of the Angolan economy, we think will not be dependent on the oil sector alone, and we will eliminate or reduce the possibilities of having Dutch disease case, as happened in some other oil countries. Our taxation system. Taxation system was inherited by Portuguese. It's an old-fashioned system. We are now in the process of renewing it. But our strategy is clear. Because of the low revenues in the majority of the Angolan population, so we reduce income taxation to revenues up to a certain level. And also, we devise a strategy to broaden the tax base rather than to increase the level of taxation because, as I said, of the low revenue level in the Angolan economy, which explains also the low saving rates that we have in our domestic economy. So we believe low taxation, but with a broader tax base, is a way to prevent tax evasion and a way of increasing, you know, public revenues. Also, we would tax some of the activities that were not taxed before. For example, public utilities like water and energy, which have, you know, meaningless taxes, and that leads to waste and to inefficiency. And those state-owned companies which provide services in those areas cannot, you know, have a meaningful role. They cannot finance their own investments because of the low taxation. So this is something that we are going to consider under the new taxation law, which is being reviewed by a commission which has been set up with the full participation of a civil society. This is what I would like to say.
Another round. I think you were first.
Hi, Dr. Jeremy. Could you give us some sense of the ways in which the Angolan economic policies are affected by supranational institutions like the IMF and World Bank, and also ways in which Angola's economic policies are affected by African institutions like the African Union, things like the NEPAD agreement within the African Union, whether there is some tendency towards regional economic strategies, whether there are programs in place for not only distributing wealth within the non-mineral sectors in the Angolan economy, but also in the wider region. Thanks.
And down here in the orange jumper.
In relation to your presentation, when you mentioned the correlation of economic development, I would like you to elaborate, if possible, in respect to social infrastructures such as hospitals, schools, roads, and because of my question is mainly because of the high proliferation of private schools and hospitals that we have in Angola now. So, I don't know if you could elaborate.
I'm going to take two more on this side of the room and then come back to this side of the room. So, here.
Thank you, Dr. Jeremy. Just to ask specifically about the banking sector, the last time I looked, one of the unique things about the Angolan banking sector was the tolerance or frequency of dollar-denominated accounts and assets inside the banking sector, which I think is fairly unique across the continent. And to ask you, why dollar-denominated accounts are tolerated in the sector and how that impacts on monetary policy and the central bank's control over money aggregates in the economy. And a related question is there capacity growing in the banking sector to actively engage with the oil sector on big-ticket project finance, or is it normal Western household name banks that are financing Angola's mineral sector? Thanks.
Thank you. And the gentleman in the red tie at the back.
Thank you. If I could just follow up on the first question in terms of what influences there are on Angola's policies. Do you consider Nigeria a model, having paid down its Paris Club debt and come to some loose agreement with the IMF and obtain a credit rating as a result?
Thank you. The first one, regarding the social infrastructure. If I understood correctly the question, you would like to know whether this is a priority in the government strategy, taking into account the proliferation of private schools and hospitals. Well, the answer is yes. But as you can understand, there is no way to prevent private initiatives from opening up schools and hospitals, because we see it as a way of contributing to address very basic social needs of the population. Obviously, it comes a question of pricing. Normally, these institutions set the price range in such a level that the majority of the population cannot afford to benefit from these services. And that's the reason why the government is as engaged in a massive program of creating schools and hospitals. There are obviously limitations, because when you build a new school or a new hospital, you have to recruit public servants. And obviously the cost of our in our budget, the weight of salaries and wages is, I would say, around 50% of our total expenditure. This is highly excessive. So how are we going to tackle that? In the one hand, to increase the offer of schools and hospitals, and on the other hand, how are we going to circumvent, you know, this restriction of not to increase public wages, not in terms of the wages themselves, but in terms of the number of public servants. We are thinking of establishing public and private partnerships. This is something we are studying. We are looking at experiences of other countries, the problems, the challenges, the difficulties that they faced, and to see how we are going to apply, you know, this concept in Angola. At the same time, there is an ongoing program to encourage public servants to retire on a voluntary basis based on a package or on alternative training, so that they can engage in another productive activity and leave, you know, the public sector. So this program takes time. It's an ongoing program. We count on some external assistance, especially in terms of donations, to carry out, you know, all these programs. But let me reiterate what I said in the beginning. Yes, we believe that the state cannot relinquish its own responsibilities in providing, you know, this basic service to the population, and that's the reason why the building of hospitals and schools constitutes a huge part in our rehabilitation of infrastructure program. the dollar-denominated accounts. Well, this has an history, obviously, as you will understand. I mentioned the macroeconomic imbalances in our economy. I mentioned the fact that in the past, the spread between the two markets was in excess of 100%. I mentioned the fact that a speculative economy developed at the time. And let me tell you that before we launched this reform program in the 80s, to possess dollars was considered a crime, a national crime, and you could be jailed for that. So, but we move on. And because of the offshore economy, which used the dollar, it was, and it is, still it is, a dollar-denominated economy, obviously the government could do little to allow for residents to have accounts in dollars, denominated in dollars. Now that there is the stabilization and the value of the kwanza is stabilized in the exchange rate market, we believe this will be a natural process. The shift into the kwanza, it's a natural process. And as long as we further reduce inflation, bringing nominal interest rates to a lower value, we believe that the population and economic agents will see the benefits of moving from dollar to kwanza. And let me tell you that recently, because of the appreciation of our exchange rate, most of those families and companies which have accounts in dollars, they have suffered, you know, some losses. And this is something inconceivable in the past. Losses were only for those who had accounts in national currency. But this is a natural process. We believe it's going to flow naturally without any administrative measure on the part of monetary authorities. We used to have the dollar accounts representing something around 85% of the total deposits in the banking system. This percentage is now reducing to a much more reasonable levels. And as long as the business community gains confidence in the recovery process and we reduce inflationary expectations, we believe there will continue to be this natural trend of moving away from products and services denominated in dollars to the national currency. The financing of the oil sector, is it done through the domestic banking system or from abroad? That's an interesting question. And we are currently discussing with the oil sector the possibility of, in this process of the Angolan content, to resort more and more to our banking system, domestic banking system. Because the argument in the beginning was financial sector was highly inefficient. Angolan banks, and when I mean Angolans, banks operating in Angolan market lacked experience, expertise, but this is no longer the case. We have already some very respected financial institutions operating in the Angolan market. So the market is sophisticating itself, is now acquiring expertise, and again, we believe time has come for a change in our policy. And we are currently discussing with the oil companies ways in which they could put their revenues more and more in the domestic banking system. Again, we don't want to force anything. We believe this is a natural process. Because when we signed these contracts with the oil companies and we accorded them some privileges, including to have their accounts offshore, obviously we don't want to be seen as disrespecting contractual obligations. We have a reputation of honoring our commitments, And that's the reason why this is a process of negotiation rather than imposing unilaterally any changes in the law. The response, I must say, from the oil sector has been very encouraging indeed. They see the strength that now the domestic banking system has, and they are considering on a voluntary basis to deposit more and more revenues in the banking system as opposed having them offshore as in the past. Nigeria is an interesting model, and it's a timely question because I have discussed extensively the Nigerian experience with the current Nigeria finance minister, who is a woman, a brave woman, I must say. And she led an interesting homegrown program in Nigeria under this new facility that IMF has put in place, which is called the... what is the name? Well, it's a new facility. I will remember the name. It's a new facility whereby a given country would implement its own economic program and IMF would just oversee its implementation and not play a more decisive role as in the past. Because IMF used to visit countries and to establish a recipe that we had to follow. And that met some criticism and resistance. And countries did not have what they themselves called ownership of the programs. And that's why the fund decided to create this new facility. So this new facility has been tested with Nigeria. We are looking at it very carefully to see whether it is applicable in the case of Angola. And let me also clarify that the last IMF mission which visited Angola a month ago came to the conclusion that Angola does not need any formal program with IMF. And that represents a dramatic change in the attitude of the IMF and the World Bank, because previously they were the ones who encouraged this attitude that first sign a formal agreement with IMF, and then you can go to Paris Club to reschedule your external debt, and you can go to the donor community and to convene a donor conference. So this change from IMF represents the recognition that the stabilization program, homegrown, as in the case of Nigeria, is in the right path. We are achieving good results, and the IMF themselves, they have stated publicly in a statement that was issued some time ago that the economic program in Angola was sustainable and was achieving very good results. So it remains to be seen how the Paris Club will react to this statement. The Minister of Finance of Angola and the Governor of the Central Bank are currently discussing with the Paris Club the possibilities of rescheduling our external debt without a formal agreement with IMF. So, to sum up, I think in the case of Angola, it will not be necessary, probably, to enter into a formal type of arrangement with IMF. But, I must say, IMF has been playing also a constructive role in the advisory role. We engage every year in these Article 4 consultations where they formulate some policy recommendations that we discuss. Some of them we follow, others we don't, but we have a very constructive dialogue between the government and the Bretton Woods institution. I'm curious to see what will be the attitude of the World Bank, because the World Bank adopted a strategy which they call an interim strategy, under which they financed, you know, some infrastructure projects. And this interim strategy was a way of waiting until the Angolan government would sign a formal agreement with IMF. And then the interim strategy would, you know, evolve to a much more, you know, substantial involvement from the World Bank. Now that IMF has said that there is no need for a formal agreement, I do not know, and I'm curious to know, what will be the position that the World Bank will adopt in the future. You know, if they will evolve to a more massive involvement in financing the Angolan economy, or if they will come up with something new. So we will see what they will say. But I'm optimistic because the results are good, are encouraging, and as they said, you know, the economic recovery program is in the right path.
I'm now going to take a round of questions from this side of the room.
Two questions really quick. The first one is there's been a lot of obviously significant improvement in the financial systems and the institutions that govern the banking sector and managing the macroeconomic component of the economy. At the same time, there has been a very slow and halting process in establishing a more basic institutional foundation for broad-based economic recovery, by which I mean there is no functional property rights regime in Angola today. And that's, do you see that as a problem and a challenge to the reforms you're trying to make in terms of being able to develop other sectors of the economy outside of minerals? And do you... The second question I'm going to tag on to the end of that is, given the fact that 70% of Angola's population is less than 25 in years, and most of those people are unemployed, do you think that this economic development will take place rapidly enough to avoid further conflict? Not to suggest that anybody has an appetite for war in Angola anymore, but there has been a spike in violent crimes recently, especially in cities. And I wonder if that is a sign of things to come, if the economic development process doesn't keep pace with the demographics.
Thank you. Gentleman here in the cream jacket.
Thank you. It's clearly important for the Angolan government to attract onshore FDI. And I wonder how you see some potential constraints or impediments to foreign direct investment in Angola. And one is widely publicized alleged human rights abuses in the context of infrastructure development around Rwanda. Another is the continuing highly restrictive business environment in the country. It's one of the most restrictive business environments, according to various surveys. And another is the continuing slippage in elections, which some people might see as lack of stabilisation.
Thank you. And the gentleman in the back row there.
Could you please talk about the measures, the fiscal and monetary measures you plan to use to control inflation further?
To control?
Inflation.
Can I tag two last questions into this one?
Yes.
Professor Simon?
Thank you. The discussion so far has been entirely at the national level in a sort of fairly abstract economic space. So I wonder if you could elaborate on the general commitment given to devolve resources and promote the provincial system of government to take account of the geographical, social, economic, and other disparities and differences within the different parts of the country.
And the last question from, I'm sorry, this has to be the last from this gentleman here. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I would like to ask Dr. Aguinaldo, what are his thoughts in terms of the business environment in Angola? Is the development go through the Angolans themselves? Is to be encouraged? What are the measures in place, the policies? And again, and then last question, in terms of the content program, what about the participation? Is diversified throughout the country? Is it mainly based in Luanda? What's your view about this? Thank you very much.
So when I finish this, probably you'll have to take me to hospital to recover. No, I'm joking. I will take these questions, you know, with pleasure. So property rights, is it a problem? Is it a challenge? Yes, yes, it is a problem. Yes, it is a problem because most of the non-performing loans in the banking sector, you know, have to do with this lack of registration of property rights. And also because our current law seems not to recognize property rights, especially in what concerns the land which belonged to the state. This is something that is in process of being changed. There is now, so you have been in Angola, I don't know whether you had the opportunity of discussing this issue, but there is an ongoing public discussion about our new land law. So we would like this law to be as consensual as it is possible. This is why there is a national debate all over the country. So there is a commission which is taking into account all the contributions received, and the final text will be elaborated and discussed in the National Assembly. At the same time, taking into account the difficulties in the registering process of these rights, so we are negotiating with the World Bank a technical assistance program to modernize this process, which is very obsolete. The process of registration is very obsolete. It was inherited from the Portuguese colony, and Portugal itself has already evolved to a much more modern system, and that's what we intend to do with technical assistance from the World Bank, and also technical assistance and funding from some bilateral donors. So this is an ongoing process. Unemployment, is it a problem? Well, obviously it's a problem. It's a problem. Would it threaten the stabilization process? I don't think so. I don't think so. It could probably bring the crime rate to a higher stage. And that is the reason why the government has to move fast, to create employment opportunities. And let me tell you that the state is playing a leading role in creating massive agricultural programs. There is one in the province of Wakukungu. I know you are familiar with that. The others may not be. And also in the province of Malanje, where we are creating massive programs to diversify agriculture with the technical assistance to give families, you know, job opportunities and income. And I'm glad to recognize, and because there is a gentleman who asked whether this program is only taking place in Luanda and not in other provinces, these programs are taking place outside Luanda. And we sincerely believe as long as they are being implemented, and we expect, you know, some results very soon, very soon. So I believe employment will rise, employment opportunities will rise, and then this would bring down our rate of unemployment, which currently I recognize is really excessively high. It stands around 30-40%. Which is really too much, and could bring, some problems. Not to the extent of threatening the stabilization program. And why I say that? Because in the past, in my view, the reason why the peace process delayed was because, in fact, there were two armies in the country. And that cannot be the case if you want to develop, you know, a country along modern rules. And the main opposition party
is transforming itself into a democratic party without any military wing, as it was the case in the past. So I sincerely believe that this can create some sort of instability, but not to the extent to threaten the stabilization program and the program of national reconciliation, which is, in my opinion, you know, well underway. Onshore foreign direct investment constraints. Yeah, we have some constraints. We recognize the lack of adequate social and economic infrastructure, and this is the reason why the government is allocated massive resources. The credit line we signed with the Republic of China amounts to $2 billion to rebuild basic infrastructure, because we are fully cognizant of the fact that this represents a major constraint in any viable project. So as long as we move on and we rebuild bridges, roads, railways, ports and airports, there is a new airport which is being built outside Luanda, for example, and all the major roads linking all the capitals are being repaired, and I believe when this process comes to an end, the real economy will have a tremendous boost and thus offering new employment opportunities. So foreign direct investment obviously plays a very important role in this process, taking into account of the low revenue and the low rate of domestic savings in the economy. And judging from the response, I am quite encouraged, despite the fact of having some constraints, but the response from the foreign capital, private capital, has been so far very encouraging. If you fly to Luanda, to Angola, you hardly find a place in a plane. All the major airlines are always fully booked. To find a place in a hotel, a five-star or four-star hotel, is always difficult because there is a massive inflow of potential foreign investors, you know, who currently visit our country to explore business opportunities. Obviously, as any other country, it's necessary to knock at the right doors, because if you find the wrong partner, this is a relationship which will not end in a marriage, but rather in a divorce, and this is not really good for anybody. But coming back to the constraints, we have asked the World Bank, and especially its business arm, the IFC, International Finance Corporation, to conduct a survey in our business environment to identify all the major constraints that we still face. And with this report, we will take whatever additional policy measures which are necessary to further attract, you know, foreign investment into the country. We have done a few things to ease the bureaucratic process. We decided to set up one-stop agency to advise foreign investors instead of knocking at different administrative bodies. There is one-stop body which advises potential foreign investors. We also set up a unit called Single Guichet for the setting up of enterprises, which is, again, a one-stop shop where you go, and if you want to register a company, so you go there in the morning and in the afternoon you have your company registered. So these are measures to reduce bureaucracy and to reduce frustrations that we know sometimes arise when foreign investors do not have their projects, you know, timely approved. Fiscal monetary measures to control inflation. So I've mentioned a few of them. We reduced the public expenditure to a sustainable level. We no longer finance the budget deficit with the credit from the central bank. We finance it by using treasury bills and treasury bonds. And by the way, the treasury now enjoys a surplus rather than a deficit, a primary surplus. And
Another measures include, on the monetary side, a high percentage of compulsory reserves on the deposits within the banking system. It's still high, we recognize that. It's around 15% of all saving deposits and current deposits in order to squeeze liquidity. And we also have some other measures of rationalization of public expenditure, as I mentioned, and to broaden our tax bases. So with a combination of all these measures, we have managed to bring, as I have mentioned, inflation down and to stabilize the value of our national currency in the exchange rate market. So we will continue to strengthen our stabilization process in order to bring further down nominal interest rates, which are still high in Angola, and prevents, you know, families and businesses from, you know, resorting to domestic banks for credits in national currency. Provincial, to what extent the provincial governments and communities are involved in the reconstruction process. The government has approved the basic program for the supply of goods and services at the provincial level, and this program is managed by the provincial governments themselves. It's not managed by the central government. And sometimes there are some disputes. They would like to receive more money, but we at the central government would like to say, yes, we are ready to send more money, but let's account for the money that has already been sent, so that we are sure that you are spending the money wisely and using to fund the projects that have been approved. So it's an experience that will evolve to some other areas. So yes, we are giving provisional governments more and more say in their own development process. Business environment, so I've already dealt with that. Is this process benefiting the Angolan themselves? We say yes. I believe for anybody wishing to invest in an environment which we do not master in all aspects, it's always good to have local partners. And it's good to recognize that there is no imposition on the part of our law that you should enter into a partnership with an Angolan partner, as was the case before. In the past, foreign companies were forced to enter into partnerships with Angolans, and the majority of the shares should, you know, be for the Angolans, 51 at least. This is no longer the case. So anybody wishing to invest is free, but it happens on a voluntary basis because we rather use indirect ways of, you know, directing foreign investors into partnership with Angolans. Fiscal incentives, special regimes in terms of taxation, custom duties, and so on, for those who enter into partnerships with Angolans. The participation of the Angolans in this Angolan content, is that being satisfactory? Yes, I would say the results are encouraging, but we recognize that more has to be done to encourage really the full participation the Angolans in the oil sector. It's not easy, because it's a sector where you, if you want to participate, you have to possess huge capital, and not many Angolans have such a capital base to participate in businesses in this field, but we are getting there. We are getting there. And as I said, the results are telling us that we are in a good track. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I'm very sorry to those of you who I wasn't able to call on. There were many hands, and this is a reflection of the huge interest your talk has generated. So thank you very much for that, and I'd like everyone to join me in thanking very warmly Dr. Aguinaldo Jaime.